Devlin describes his new documentary Blast as a movie capturing astrophysics Indiana Jones style. The film follows Mr. Devlin's brother Mark, an astrophysicist at the University of Pennsylvania, and his Canadian colleague Barth Netherfield as they travel to Sweden and later to Antarctica in an attempt to launch a telescope into space to gather information on how our universe evolved. Paul Devlin is a 5-time Emmy Award winner for his work on NBC's Olympics and CBS's Tour de France. He's also directed 2 other films, Slam Nation and Power Trip. And Blast began a 6-day run at the Cinema Village on East 12th Street today. I'm very pleased to welcome Paul and Mark Devlin to the show. Hello.
Thanks very much, Larry.
Paul, you've directed 2 other films and worked in TV. Would you have been accused of nepotism if your brother's work wasn't so interesting and potentially important?
Well, the thing is, because he's my brother, I had great access to his experiment. So in some ways, I was perhaps the only person who could tell this story.
Whose idea was it?
Well, Mark sort of invited me very casually to join him several weeks later as he launched the balloon in Sweden. And so it was his idea initially, but at first I said, well, no, I'm not really interested in that. I'm not sure what we can do with that. I said, well, I'd be interested if you can get me a free flight to Sweden and put me up. And so I didn't expect anything to happen, but then he did. So I showed up expecting to be there for 3 or 4 days to capture the launch, and I wound up being there for 4 or 5 weeks.
And did NASA think this was all right, or Dr. Netherfield?
Oh, it was fine with everybody else. I just said, hey, my brother's going to come to film the launch. We didn't know he was going to have the camera in our face for 5 weeks. And
you would lose all your privacy.
Basically, yes.
Why did you call the film Blast?
Mark can answer that about the telescope.
Well, when you're going to submit a proposal to NASA for a lot of money, you usually come up with a cool acronym. So it stands for the balloon borne, that's obvious. Large aperture, it just means a big mirror. Submillimeter, that's the wavelength that we work in, and it's a telescope. So Blast, there you go.
And you say during the film that the BLAST project was revolutionary. What were you trying to accomplish with this that couldn't have been done other ways?
Well, the problem, and I guess the good thing for us, is that the light that we're looking for, the submillimeter light, doesn't make it through the Earth's atmosphere. And so if you want to observe it, you've got to get above most of the atmosphere.
So you launch a satellite, don't you?
Well, you would launch a satellite. Satellites cost quite a chunk of change, somewhere between cheap satellites, $200 million, and expensive ones, $2 billion. In fact, there is a satellite which is on its way into orbit right now, which is going to do much the same science as we did. We just got there first. So
it's much cheaper to go on a balloon, that's
yeah,
for sure.
Balloons are cheap.
Although this was not an inexpensive project.
Oh, no. Millions of dollars are involved with this. It's a sophisticated piece of equipment with detectors which are state-of-the-art, and the telescope is state-of-the-art. Everything's state-of-the-art. It's just that you can do it. You don't have to have a rocket.
And how long before you actually could launch the balloon did you work on this thing? The telescope must have taken years.
Not really. Actually, we had it all together quite quickly. It's fine-tuning it to get it so it's working. Like I said, it's complicated, so getting it to work right. And then you can't just walk down to Antarctica and launch a balloon. You've got to schedule it, and that's usually a couple years to get in the queue and get up in the air.
So you have this balloon that can travel pretty high above the atmosphere.
Yep.
And you've attached a telescope to it. And then how do you control that to look at what you want to look at? I'm not even sure what you wanted to look at.
Well, we're looking at a very small patch of sky about the size of if you hold your thumb at arm's length a couple times that. If you build a telescope on the Earth, it's really easy. You know, you put a motor on the Earth and you torque against the motor and you point wherever you want to point. From a balloon, it's a little tougher, right? The balloon is going to go wherever the heck the winds are going, but that's okay. We can, we're really pointing to is with respect to the star or something like that. And so you put pointing sensors on it and gyroscopes and all the fancy equipment, and you can actually control it quite well.
And you were looking for the earliest history you could possibly find?
We're basically looking for the epoch when stars were forming in galaxies like our own. So when you look at a galaxy which is 7 billion light years away, you're looking at a galaxy when the universe is only about 7 billion years old. And at that time, these galaxies like ours was forming stars hundreds of times the rate at which it's forming stars now.
Why wouldn't the Hubble have looked into that?
Well, it's an interesting question. The when stars form, they form in big clouds of gas and dust. And the dust in the clouds, actually, it's like being on a foggy day. You put a light inside a big cloud, and the light doesn't get out. But in our case, the light from the stars, which are very, very luminous, warms up the cloud just a little bit. And so warm to me, because I used to work in the cosmic microwave background, so that's 3 degrees above absolute zero. Warm to me is 30 degrees above absolute zero. And so the clouds are really, really huge. So they put out a lot of power, but they're putting in a very, very long wavelength light, and the Hubble just doesn't have the instrumentation to see it.
And you created a telescope specifically to capture this.
It's like an experiment, so it's a very specific set of goals and capabilities.
Now, Paul, the first attempt was in Sweden, so why did you begin the movie the way that you did in Antarctica?
Well, it's sort of a cliffhanger to catch people in and let them know where we're going. And that's a pretty common technique, actually, to get people in the audience, get the suspense going, and then approach it as a flashback, the narrative as a flashback to how they got there.
And it sets the tone for the film,
right?
Which is that there can be many mishaps along the way.
Exactly.
Science is mostly mistakes.
Yeah. And that's part, one of the things that we wanted to show is that scientists often fail, and they need to be allowed to fail. And ultimately, in this case, they don't fail, but they got a lot of failures along the way, and we sort of chart that, the crazy situations that they go through in order to make this happen. A lot of it's amazingly haphazard. I mean, they're just throwing this thing up into space and letting the winds take it.
Mm-hmm. And that's what the idea was from Sweden, to launch it above the above the Arctic, and it would just float over to Canada and fall at a certain point?
Well, controlled fall, hopefully, but we would like to actually go all the way around. In fact, I would prefer to launch from Sweden than Antarctica, just because the places to look are nicer. But we can't fly over Russia for, I guess, obvious reasons, so we cut down.
Even now? I mean, even now. Wouldn't Russian scientists be interested in what you're collecting?
Yeah, but it's, you know, it's politics, and NASA's tried for years to get that agreement in place, but it's just tough.
You also have to worry about where the sun is, don't you?
That's right. So we like the sun and we hate the sun. We like it because it charges our solar panels, our batteries, and we like it because it keeps the balloon nice and warm so we don't sag.
And you have 24-hour daylight up there. Yeah,
right. It's 24 hours when you go above the Arctic Circle in June, which is where we were.
Although it rained most of the time. Was that something you could have predicted?
Well, of course, when it's raining, when we're flying, it doesn't really matter. But when we're launching, yeah, it's a real hassle. Mostly it's winds that cause this problem, and the wet was just, I didn't fully appreciate how wet it was up in Sweden.
They had the worst weather in 100 years in Sweden during my stay there. But that also what brought out a lot of the drama, all that tension and the tough things that they were going through in order to launch was what got the film going at the beginning.
Well, you've said that you were worried you wouldn't get enough footage to make for an interesting film.
Yeah,
you had
right.
No idea there would be so many setbacks. I guess that made the film a lot more dramatic than you could have predicted. What would have happened if everything had just gone perfectly?
Well, that would be a lot less
dramatic.
That'd
be a short.
Right. Well, we had about 200 hours of film in the end, so we had a lot of stuff.
But I wouldn't have minded if it went perfectly.
Yeah, there was a lot of back and forth about what was good for the film and what was good for the experiment.
Well, I'd imagine at the point of launch, there's an incredible amount of tension.
Oh, well, I mean, I think that's it's hard to express how, because we're up for maybe 24, 36 hours before launch to try and get this thing going. It's a long preparatory stage. And sure, it launches, and then it's out of control, right? So you know, we can certainly talk to it, but if a wire breaks or something happens, you're out of luck.
And a wire broke.
Actually, no, no. Oh, wire
something,
broke.
Something
yeah.
happened
lots
in the
things,
first. The first
of,
telescope
don't get away too
jiggled
much,
around.
Yeah. There's a lot that went wrong.
A lot went wrong, and so but that you know we fixed it all and we flew it again. I mean, we make the point in the movie that ballooning is supposed to be, you know, you're not supposed to fail, but it's supposed to be risky and you can correct the things and do it again. Whereas with a satellite, of course, you can't do that.
Now, you were shooting during the summertime in Sweden, and mm-hmm. then when you went to Antarctica again right. in the summertime, mm-hmm. would it have been possible for you to even filmed in the cold of winter?
Well, in winter, they wouldn't have done it. It just wouldn't have been possible to launch at that time. But yeah, it would be much more difficult. But that's just luckily they shoot in the summer in Antarctica, and we were.
And
there.
How? What were the temperatures like at that time?
Actually, Antarctica on the coast where we are in McMurdo Base is not so bad. I mean, it's you get there and it's about minus. Oh, well, let me see. Convert from centigrade. It's probably about minus. It's about 20 degrees Fahrenheit or so. And
20 degrees Fahrenheit. Oh, yeah. We get that in New York.
On a sunny day, it's not bad. It's like spring skiing kind of thing.
And you also have a lot more social life down there because McMurdo is a place where there are an awful lot of people doing other kinds of science.
McMurdo would be a large town for a large fraction of our country. So it's, you know, they've got a lot going on. And what's great about it is they're there to get science done. And so you need something it's all about making your stuff happen. That's great.
But you wound up after the first launch in the Canadian Arctic Archipelago with an armed local protecting you from polar bears.
Yep, Kevin was our polar bear spotter, and he came with his grandfather's rifle to protect us from the polar bears. Didn't see any polar bears, but we did see some local wildlife. Mm. Which he promptly tried to shoot, but
we didn't put that in the movie.
And the whole thing wound up rather frustrating. Did you get any valuable information from that?
Oh, certainly. We published quite a few papers on that one, and quite a few PhD theses came out of it, but it wasn't the science that I was going after, and so we had to really fix it up and do it again, and that's why we went to Antarctica.
My guests are Mark Devlin and Paul Devlin. We're talking about a film called Blast, which premiered yesterday at the IFC and then opened today at Cinema Village on East 12th Street. And I gather you're going to be talking to audiences today and tomorrow?
Sure. We did a Q&A last night after the movie, which for about a half an hour, which went really well. People come to these things with really good questions, and they see the movie and they want them answered, and I don't mind doing that. That's great.
After the 7 o'clock show tonight and the 9 o'clock show, and also on Saturday, we'll be doing Q&As.
Well, we have been talking about science so far, but this is also about the people involved, and you made it as human interest as you could. Mm. And we learn all sorts of interesting things. For example, the other major scientist involved in this thing had all sorts of differences of opinion on basic things like whether God exists.
Sure. Bart Netterfield, who's my colleague from the University of Toronto, is a great scientist, one of the best I know, but he also happens to be a devout Christian, and he's raised that way, his family's that way, and he's not the kind of guy who comes in and, you know, we run a bunch of scientists and tell us we're all wrong, but if you query him on what his opinions are, he's happy to give them, and he's got a very pragmatic view about the whole thing.
It's my sense that he's a rarity among scientists working in this area.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, you're not going to go to any average astronomy department and find a bunch of people who believe the same thing he does.
Has this caused any audience reaction, that whole discussion of religion and its importance to top scientists? People have seen the film so far.
Yeah, this is Paul. The presenting Bart's religious views in the film is a controversial, especially in the States, among certain segments of scientists. And they basically object to Bart's point of view. And I've actually been told if I want to show this in schools, which is one of our great ambitions, is to get this out to young people, to get them excited about science, that I should remove those elements.
But he isn't suggesting creation science. He's simply saying that he personally believes there's a God, and that's why this whole thing, you know, the universe is beautiful in the way that it is.
He's not a literalist, which is interesting, and he's managed to reconcile his religious beliefs with his scientific pursuit, which is I found fascinating, which is why I wanted to include it in the film. And as Mark points out, there are no contradictions, as far as I can tell. Is that true, Mark?
Yeah, I mean, he doesn't say anything that I can't tell him he's wrong. I mean, if he told me that there's creationism, I'd say, well, I mean, look at the bones, right? And he'd have a hard time. But he doesn't do that, and because he's not an idiot, right? He's very clear about what he believes.
But it is interesting that so much of the debate often is over whether creationism is something that we should allow in the schools, and now we discover that there are people on the other side who are saying we shouldn't discuss religion when we're talking about certain scientific things.
It's true. I mean, my brother I'm not sure he coined it, but introduced me to the term scientific fundamentalism, where, you know, there are some scientists who just absolutely will not accept anybody else's point of view on this, and I don't go as far as objecting to them, but it seems a little unreasonable, just like I would think a religious fundamentalist would be unreasonable.
How did your family react to all of the footage devoted to them? Because the film does spend a lot of time revealing the strain that you and your family undergo during these long stretches away from home.
Well, like my brother said, he had access to my house, so, and you wouldn't let a normal, you know, some stranger in your house to start filming, so he comes by with his camera, and it's all of a sudden Paul's filming again, and so it was interesting. I think my sons were a little young. They were, you know, 5 and 7 at the time to really react to it. I think they think it's pretty cool because I go give talks at their school, and my wife was happy to play along.
And you that means you were going back and forth, or you had another camera crew that was going to the house?
Getting to Antarctica was actually really difficult. It took me 3 or 4 months of struggle, and I wasn't actually sure I was going to make it. There were a lot of points in this film where we weren't sure it was going to get finished. And so I, in anticipation of that, sent cameras down to Antarctica prior to my arrival. And the scientists were shooting each other. And so that was actually very useful because the graduate students sort of opened up even more to each other, and we got some great footage from that.
And you were shooting with high def?
Well, we started out in mini DV because this was not funded at first, and then later on the BBC came on in Sweden. We got a lot of European television, so then we sort of graduated up to higher end and high def. Thankfully, with the beautiful Antarctica footage, we were in high def by that point. But I had people shooting Mark in Antarctica as well as the family. So, for example, we have both sides of a conversation over the phone where I get both of them.
The film ends while the data is still being collected. So I'm assuming that a lot has happened since the end of the film.
Certainly. It's been kind of a race for us because the satellite was launching that was going to basically do what we did better. So we wanted to make sure that we got the cream off the top quickly. But you have to remember, it's not like we're taking a picture like Hubble would do, and you can say, let's slap that up on the screen, and there you go. It's a very detailed statistical analysis of what's happening. But we did that as fast as we could, and we got our data published in Nature a couple of weeks ago, and our major papers are all out.
And what have you learned that is new?
Well, basically, without going into too much detail, because Paul yells at me,
it doesn't compete with the film, Paul. Why?
No. Yeah. Go to detail, Mark. Go for it.
Go for it. Okay.
Well, I have a very intelligent audience. Here.
Okay. So basically the idea is that if you take a look at all the stars that were ever made in the universe and add them all up and say, where's the starlight? Half of the starlight that was ever produced by every star that ever existed was absorbed by this dust and then re-emitted in the submarine, reprocessed basically. And so if you want to know what half of the universe is doing in terms of stars, you've got to go and observe it here. And to date, basically the only thing we've been able to do is from the ground. And it's very, very dicey, even from the highest telescopes in Hawaii. So what we were able to do is to say, well, we know that half the light in the universe is now coming from these dusty clouds. We were able to show that they were coming from individual galaxies as opposed to something that we didn't understand. And so that was the major thing. And then we basically subdivide that up and say, well, now half of that star formation is happening at a certain range and distances in the universe. So in this case, about 9 billion years and before is where most of the activity is happening, and things like that.
So stars form from reprocessed energy?
Basically, stars form from mostly hydrogen. Stars are made mostly hydrogen. But after the first couple generations of stars go out, the gas is contaminated by dust. And when I mean dust, I mean like very small grains of silicates, which are about 2 microns in size. And that contamination is what absorbs the light. So, and you just can't see through it in the optical. So if you want to see these stars, you really have to look at the power that they emitted but reprocessed by this.
My guests have been Paul and Mark Devlin. Paul's a filmmaker. Mark is an astrophysicist at the University of Pennsylvania. The film, based on two expeditions, it's called Blast, and it began a 6-day run today at the Cinema Village on East 12th Street. They will be taking questions from the audience after the 7 and 9 p.m. screenings tonight at Cinema Village, and then tomorrow Paul will be there to take questions again for the 7 and 9 p.m. screenings Sunday at the 5:10 p.m. screening. And I want to thank the two of you for coming by to talk with us today around... Is it just about noon? Oh, no, 1 o'clock, isn't
it? Yeah. 1 o'clock. So thank you, Leonard.
I don't know what it is in Antarctica.
Thanks very much.